Welcome, everyone, to the Durham Museum Podcast. I am your curator, Carrie Meyer, and today we're going to explore an event that many people can't quite believe happened here in Omaha, Nebraska. The Trans-Mississippi and International Exposition welcomed literally millions of people to our city in 1898. It was the impetus for infrastructure construction like roads, sewer lines, and it showcased the first electric lights in the city. And yet you'd never know it had been here. The buildings are gone, and outside of some souvenirs that you might find in your attic or basement from a great-great-grandparent who attended, there is virtually nothing left from this historic event. Well, the Trans-Miss may be long gone, but it is in no way forgotten. My guest today and our resident exposition expert at the Durham Museum is Jean Johnson. Retired teacher and UNL graduate, Jean has volunteered her talents at the Durham Museum since 1991. She is a longtime museum docent and has led the From Expositions to Jazz Musicians River City History Tour for 6 years. Jean also teams up with her husband Lee on one of our newer tours, Parks and Boulevards, which explores the beautiful parks and boulevard system Omaha began developing in the late 1800s. Jean also has a passion for art. She leads our guided museum tours and teaches visitors about the Art Deco architecture of Union Station. Jean, thanks so much for coming on the show today.
It is my pleasure.
Well, Jean, our visitors may not be familiar with the Trans-Mississippi and International Exposition, which we're just going to call the Trans-Miss or the Expo.
Fair enough.
It's just too long. What can you tell us about it?
Well, it was the World's Fair that Omaha, Nebraska put on. In 1898, as you mentioned, began in June and ended in November. And it was part museum complex, part state fair, part livestock show, part living history display, part Kearney Midway. So it had a little bit of everything. This was the golden age of expos and world's fairs. And Omaha was ready to take on the world.
So how did it come here? How did we get to host this?
Well, prior to this, there was a reason we had the fair. Omaha had been taking off like gangbusters in the late 1800s. But then about 1893, there was a depression that hit the whole country. And on top of that, there were 2 years of drought. So every aspect of the early economy was hit. And people were starting to suffer, and so was the city. And so instead of growing, they were afraid, the movers and shakers in town, were afraid of a decline. So, as I mentioned, fairs were a very popular form of entertainment, and the Chicago World's Fair had been a huge success in 1893. So the impetus was, well, if we could stage this here, get people to realize that there's a lot going on here. We have resources, we have people, and it's a thriving community, that maybe we can get past this slump. So that was the reason for it. And I think part the reason it ended up in Omaha, there was a strong community support for it, business and civic leaders. And Omaha had William Jennings Bryan pushing the case for Nebraska.
Okay. Were there any other city leaders we would recognize? Any other names that were involved that you can think of?
Well, the two that jump to my, the one you will have heard of, I'm sure, because it was Herman Kuntz, and we have Kuntz Memorial Church and Kuntz Park. We'll talk about that. And then, but the man who really spearheaded it was a 9-member committee, and his name was Gurdon Wattles. And he came to Omaha. He had been a teacher. He got involved in banking, came here for opportunity, and took a big part in the early civic leadership. And he was the man that had the business awareness and drive to move things forward. So he'd be the other one, whether or not you've heard of him. he was the main dynamo.
Gotcha. And who was the architect of the Trans-Miss? He was rather well known here in Omaha.
I'd say you mean Thomas Kimball.
Yes.
And his partner, who was Howard Walker. They were a they had their own business in town, and a lot of Kimball projects, as you said. He mm-hmm. St. Cecilia's Church and the Burlington Station, among others. So he was, I call him the Starkitect, because he really was the guy. Yeah. They were in charge of And when we think of the Transmiss, I think the most image that pops into people's mind is the main exhibition area. To me, I think of it as just a museum complex. There were 7 major buildings. Each one had a different theme. And those were the ones that they really had a firm hand on how there were many architects that, you know, built those buildings. But Kimball and Walker were the ones that said, well, it has to look like this. And their idea was that it needed to be, if you could have taken that building and put it in ancient Greece or Rome, that's the look, the neoclassical. They had to be a certain height. They were all painted white. And then they had gray-green roofs. So it was called the White City. So, yes, that was their stamp on that.
Okay. And that was just in the Grand Court area, that architecture style?
Yes. Otherwise, the whole fair went over 184 acres. So it was a huge expanse. So there were 3 tracks. And the one we've just been talking about was called the Kunsttrack. Okay. That's the main exhibition area. And then overlooking the Bluff track overlooked the Missouri River. And that was where all the participating states that wanted to have a display set up their own buildings. So they reflected the states they were representing. Okay. And then the huge North track, where the Indian Congress was, and a lot of the Midway and other displays, the livestock were out there, that went way north. So the area we're talking about that was all temporary, mm-hmm. but these big buildings were never built to last.
And what area was that in town? Where would the people think of it today?
Okay, well, if you're familiar with Omaha, I'll use street names.
Right.
It ran from 16th Street to 24th Street, and then Pinckney to Pratt. It was an 11-acre area.
Okay.
And those buildings, there's nothing there today because they were never meant to last. The style of these buildings was determined, but they were made out of something called staff. And while they looked like marble and granite, it was really just wooden framework over which they put this material that was plaster of Paris, a little bit of cement, and horsehair. And it was cheap, and it was durable enough because this was only supposed to go 5 months or so. So that's why. Now, I will have to say, since we're talking about
yes.
Durham, if you come down there mm-hmm. and you want to see an actual fragment of a building, we have one on display because in about the 1980s, so almost 100 years after the fair, they were putting in new sewer lines. And lo and behold, here comes this decorative plaster out of the ground. And they were on the site of one of the major buildings. So it was saved, thank heaven, they brought sure. it back, and we have it on display.
Awesome. And we do have a model, if you want to see what the Grand Court looked like, that 16th to 24th Pinckney to Pratt area, that whole model, that scale model of that. So what is there today? What is in this area that was a Transmiss, since everything is pretty much gone?
Right.
What
well, is when you go there today, it is Kunst Park in the Kunst Park neighborhood. Those of you familiar, again, with Omaha streets, Florence Boulevard, and that would take you through right where the main exhibition and the lagoon was. When you go there today, you'll see a park, a playground area, and if you know the buildings that were there, you will see that the gazebo, where you could have a picnic, has made with that kind of a little homage to what was there because it has columns, it's painted white, and it has a gray-green roof.
Oh,
so
nice.
It's kind of fun if you know that. And then there are a couple historical plaques. There's one about the Transmiss, and there's one about the Wild West Show. So you'll know when you're there, but it helps if you've gone first to the museum
yep.
and you've kind of seen the visuals we have because once you get there, it's pretty much virtual. Mm-hmm.
Well, you mentioned the Wild West Show, and that was one of the main attractions in the fair. So tell a little bit about why was Buffalo Bill here?
Well, he had been to Omaha years before and was very familiar on his buffalo hunting days. Often they would start here, catch the train here, and go west. So he was familiar with Omaha, and when he decided to have the show, he had tried it out a little bit before, but this really was his first trial run. And as you know, it was internationally famous mm-hmm. and successful, but it really saw the first light of day here at the fair. And it ran for several days. It wasn't here the entire time, okay. So that is a little misleading.
Sure.
But, oh, definitely, he got his start here.
And you had mentioned a couple times the Indian Congress. Can you talk just a little bit about what that was and kind of why that was here?
Yes. The idea was, this was 1898. So for the most part, Native Americans had been moved off their native lands. Mm-hmm. And there was a newspaperman in town, Edward Rosewater, the Omaha Bee.
Yes.
Colorful character.
Very colorful. We could do a whole podcast on him.
Yes. Yes, you could. But his idea was to highlight, and while people who still knew the old ways were still alive. So he got with an ethnologist, James Mooney. They didn't want it to be an Indian sideshow. They wanted it to be really, when I said earlier that there was a living history aspect to this, that was supposed to be the idea. Not that it didn't segue into the mock battles, because it did. Mm-hmm. However, it gave almost 600 Native Americans ended up coming to that, representing 35 tribes. And some of the things they had, the traditional lodging, you'd see the dancing, the music, the crafts, the clothing, the games, the utensils. It was the real thing.
It was their life.
It was. So that was what it was all about, and that's why it was such, and it was a 4-acre space out there.
Okay.
So it was set up to be as much as it could be a realistic depiction.
And do you have a sense of how it was received? Are there any is there any documentation about how
Huge,
people fell about
wildly
it?
Wildly popular.
Okay.
Wildly popular. And then among some of the people who came, Geronimo, who was a prisoner at Fort Sill in Oklahoma, but he was brought with several other tribesmen that were being held as prisoner there. He was about 70 years old at the time. But he was Geronimo.
Exactly.
And so he was a huge draw. I found it very interesting. At one point, when President McKinley was here, we can talk about that in a bit.
Sure.
President McKinley and then General Nelson Miles, who was the who captured Geronimo, they met face to face, but they had a very dignified greeting.
Oh, wow.
And I thought that was...
That's quite
That must have been something to see.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Wow. So you would there was obviously several other things going on at the expo. Can you talk a little bit about what was the atmosphere like? What would you see? Like, what would the experience have been at the fair?
Well, that's a great question. And I think anyone who's ever been to any kind of a fair, just think about what it was like. You walk in and you probably smell the hot dogs cooking or the donuts or whatever, the hot
funnel cakes.
Oil. Yeah, there you go. That's what I was trying to think of. And, you know, you have the excitement of the crowd and the noise, and you hear people screaming from the rides, and it's just so thrilling. And that's what this was like on steroids.
Okay.
Because the size of it was so overwhelming. And when you think about, if you lived in Omaha, you would have had... By 1898, you would have had electricity, and you would have had phones. But if you were a farm person, and never had been working, everything would have been so rural for you to mm-hmm. come here and see this would have just been like magic, just like magic.
So a little bit like going to Oz.
Yes, yes, just like that. Yeah. And apparently, funny you should mention that, because, you know, at the end of The Wizard of Oz, when Dorothy takes... misses her balloon ride, it says Omaha on there.
Yes, it does.
And that's because this was such a big deal in the day and when that was written. Huh. So, yes, that wasn't just by mistake.
That's fantastic.
Yeah.
I totally did not know that before I said that.
Yay.
So I just learned
something new. Good.
So, you know, you've talked a little bit about the midway, you know, and so the midway today we think of like the throw the ball and knock the bottles over and win a stuffed teddy bear.
Yes.
Was that the midway of the Trans-Mississippi, or was it a little different?
I'll go back to the title. It was the Trans-Mississippi and International Exposition. And I will say that in the main exhibition area, hold that thought for a minute.
Sure.
But in the main exhibition area, there was an effort to have international displays. Mm. But by and large, really, the whole idea was to highlight the resources, the products, the technology, the opportunity of the Midwest. So there, and interestingly enough, I found out when they were trying to find people to exhibit from foreign countries, Omaha was the Wild West. And they thought, why? Who's going to come?
Right.
2.6 million
right.
came. But to tell someone in Paris or London, you really should do this, was a real hard sell. So and there were, particularly in the manufacturers building, that was the most international. But when you came to the Midway, you were in another planet. There was where you would have the Street of All Nations. You might have seen a snake charmer.
Okay.
Maybe some dancing girls.
Ooh,
fortune tellers.
Yes.
And, you know, mirror mazes that were hugely popular. And then when you turned off of that, you could walk down the streets of Cairo. You would have seen or perhaps been riding on a camel. There were ostriches. There were wild animals along the way. There was a Japanese tea garden. There was a Chinese pagoda. There was a German beer garden. I mean, the world was here. And so it would have been a little different than toss the ball and get a teddy bear.
Sure.
But those kinds of games were there as well. But those were the sites on that area. And then food from those exotic areas, because most of those, the foreign countries, would have had some type of tasting set up or restaurant.
It's like the Victorian Epcot.
There you are. That's a good description. Yes. We'll come back to how people would have been dressed during that. But
yes.
I can tell you about two really fun attractions. Typically, there would be, it was an idea, good idea to have something large that people could see and start getting excited about from a distance. You know, and even today we have roller coasters that you see from miles out if you go to World of Fun. And when you're at the Navy Pier, you still see the Ferris wheel. So there were two rides that were just wildly popular. One was called Shooting the Chutes. There was a platform that was about 108 feet.
Oh,
and you would get in something that looked like a boat or a toboggan. Eight people could ride at a time. You'd come flying down this chute, and you'd end in a pond. And you were going probably over 100 miles an hour.
Holy.
And then you'd ricochet across the water, and they said people did not get wet. But I would imagine if you're thinking of the dates this ran, it would have felt pretty good, probably if you got a little splash of water on you.
Yeah.
But that's very similar ride to what you'd see in the big amusement parks today.
Yeah. It's a log ride, basically. Yeah,
it is the log ride, exactly. Yeah. And it was called Shooting the Chutes.
Okay.
And like other rides that we have today, they went from fair to fair. So.
Sure.
That would have been the life of that. And then the other one was called the Giant Seesaw. And again, there was a 100-foot tower. So you saw it from a ways off.
Yep.
And then the crossbeam was about 200 feet. And on either end of this crossbeam, there was a basket. The pictures, it kind of looks like a small, like even a railroad or trolley, bus kind of thing. So maybe 20 people could fit in those. And it was just a slow, mechanized ride up and down. That was it.
Huh.
But if you can imagine, this was before airplanes. There were hot air balloons we just referenced.
Right.
But you wouldn't have had an aerial view of this. And it must have been spectacular to go up there, then you'd be 200 feet in the air.
Yeah.
And to look at this huge expanse. And at nighttime, of course, the lights would have come on.
Mm-hmm.
And I also learned that it must have been very romantic because very often young couples would say their vows.
Oh.
And I think it must have been the wedding destination trip in the 1898. So
oh,
a lot of
fantastic.
Weddings were,
So you mentioned dress. Where, I mean, there's lots of ladies in white dresses running around,
yes,
and grooms and brides, or
well, just everybody was kind of dressed. You wouldn't have gone unless you had on your very best. Was not a casual time, this Victorian era. Ladies would have had dresses down to their ankles, wrist covered, neck, always a hat, probably a parasol because it would have been sunny. They would have had gloves, stockings, button-up shoes. And as I said, this is in the summertime. Mm-hmm. Would have been very uncomfortably warm. Gentlemen didn't get off much easier. They would have had, you know, a suit with a vest and a jacket, white shirt, bow tie, and again, the hat. Or even children, you know. So they would have, boys would have had a short pants, suspenders, and, you know, just a shorter, more childlike version, and sure, the same for the little girls. But still, it would have been, you wouldn't have thought to go to the fair without your very best. Mm-hmm.
And these are probably made out of wool at this point. I mean, this is
the
not
the men's
a,
would have been for sure, yeah, I would think.
Yeah, or like a linen, cotton,
heavier.
Something heavy.
Linen. If you were lucky enough to have that, that would have been...
preferable.
Preferable, yeah, that's the word.
Because there's several layers there in Victorian fashion.
Yes.
I mean, it's not like one petticoat.
No,
it's,
it never ends.
You know, three or four, and then...
Yep.
I have enough problems wearing jeans in the summer, so that does not sound pleasant.
Nope.
So were there any other, we mentioned the figures that attended the Indian Congress.
Yeah.
Were there other dignitaries that came to Omaha during this time to be seen at the fair?
Yes. And actually, to start the fair off, President McKinley in Washington, D.C. pushed a button that sent an electrical charge that turned on the lights that started the fair. He did come in person, but he was there in spirit when it started. And then that reminds me, I do want to mention one other thing. Two things about this fair were remarkable for its time. One, it started on time. Unheard of. They had slightly over a year to get this done.
Wow.
It was a remarkable feat. And I'd mentioned Gordon Wattles, I attribute his business leadership to getting that done. The other thing that made it remarkable was it actually made money. The funds for this came from stockholders. You could buy stock in the fair, and of course, wealthy people and big companies, the Union Pacific and such, they could buy large chunks. But individuals for $10 could get a share, and the shareholders received dividends of 90% on the dollar. So it was a remarkable feat. And again, Mr. Wattles was a banker, so he managed it. But the way this worked was bringing in, like, the celebrity, mm-hmm, the president, there were certain days. And out of the 100, I think the whole fair was 150-some days, but 70 of those days were designated to either honor different states, cities, civic groups, politicians, or the military.
Oh.
So it would bring in, it was very smart, you'd bring in all the people associated with that particular niche, and it kept the flow of new people coming in. It cost 50 cents for adults to attend and 25 for children, which was steep. The worker of the day was earning $3 a day.
Oh, wow.
But they did have a discount on Sunday.
Oh.
So these days brought people in. I mentioned William Jennings Bryan. During the war, this time period, the Spanish-American War was fought. Mm. And it began in February of the year this was to open.
Oh, okay.
So all funding was cut off from the government. And posed a huge dilemma to the runner, the men that running the show, because it'd be very poor form to celebrate when your country's at war. I mentioned that on this main exhibition area, there was a beautiful lagoon, mm-hmm, that ran for 6 blocks long. The average width was 150 feet, and at the end, it broke into a trefoil that was 450 feet across. So they thought, now what could we do? So they decided that every afternoon at 3, they would stage the mock sinking of the battleship Maine as if it was Havana Harbor. And then everyone would watch this. They'd cheer for the United States. And it was a very patriotic way. And fortunately for all involved, the war ended in April. So and it was an interesting, when you think nothing happens in a vacuum.
Right.
And so
even after the war ended, they still staged the...
Yes.
They still staged the
yes.
battle. Okay.
Yes. So, you know, that brought in, those are the only names that come to mind right now, but
sure.
I think at the time they had a lot of local celebrities that would have highlighted those days. And some of the days I had, there was Boys and Girl Scouts, and of course when Buffalo Bill was there. And a day meant you had this huge parade highlighting whichever group you were. One day it was the Ladies Floral Association, and they had
oh, wow.
all decorations, postal clerks and the mayors and military days. So that was, I thought, a clever
That's
way.
Brilliant.
Yeah.
Yes, absolutely. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So we've talked about all the really fun things, how this was a great opportunity for Omaha to welcome folks. And everything was smooth sailing, right? I mean, there was never any hiccups in the fair. Nothing went wrong. Right?
Well, yeah, exactly. Except for
all of it.
No, honestly. Well, there was the usual. I mean, they did have there was a complete feast, police force. So I mean, there was pickpockets and
sure.
nothing horrendous, but there was petty crime. And in the summer, because of the heat and all, they had a hospital. I was noticing once, I was just kind of reading over some of the issues, but there were broken bones. People would, you know, take a slip.
Sure.
And a lot of heat related. But, you know, we talked about that. Dress the way
clothing.
They were. And the clothing. And, yeah, just the, you know, just the summer in Nebraska. So, but the one thing that came to mind thinking about this was all the buildings were temporary, except there was supposed to be a permanent, well, when you think of other world's fairs, when you think of Paris, mm-hmm. what do you think of?
What do I think of?
Yep.
Like the, was that the Eiffel Tower?
Yes, ma'am. I put you on the spot.
You did. I was like, I'm going to say something bad.
No.
No, but yeah, so there's always something left behind.
Now,
right?
I won't put you on the spot of this one, but fine. What about Seattle?
The Space Needle?
I had a girl. So when we had Omaha, I should have said, and what about Omaha? And you would have, had it been built, you would have said, oh, that would be the Arch of the States. Now, the only place you can actually go through the Arch of the States is if you come to the Durham and you enter our display, because we have a beautiful mock-up of it. The idea behind that was that each state would have native rock, native stone. And there were, well, at least 9 major ones. There were some, you know, that hadn't done quite as much in it. But that was the plan. And they even had a, you know, a dedication of the main, you know, they started it. But it never happened. Huh. And for whatever reason, my theory is, again, I think of Mr. Waddles, if it wasn't going to get done on time, and if it wasn't coming together, it wasn't going to happen because that fair was going to open. I'm still, you know, that's the beauty of this. There's still so many, every time I think about something, I think of something else I have to find
sure.
out. So if anybody knows. but that's my guess, for because it was as ephemeral as the rest of it.
Sure.
So that was something that I really think he probably thought long and hard, because it would have been a great memorial. It would have been huge. It would have looked like those triumphal arches
sure.
you see in Rome. It was massive. Mm-hmm. And what they built was, but it was, again, temporary. So,
was it a funding thing, you think, because of the war and the funding getting
perhaps,
cut off, possibly?
To be determined.
Yeah. Mysteries continue.
it probably is more than one thing.
Oh, sure.
More than one thing. But the fact that they laid the cornerstone, or they started it, and had a big dedication. So something major.
Something happened.
Mm-hmm.
Got it. So we had talked about the the innovation, the inventions, and things like that. Are there things that we would recognize today that were debuted here in Omaha, or were there very, what were some of the interesting new technologies of the day?
Well, I made a list because I didn't want to forget some of these things. Water faucets.
Oh.
Uh-huh. X-ray machines were on display. Food-wise, you had Jell-O, snow cones.
Summer staple.
Yeah, absolutely. Electric fans. Not without the without the safety shield, I must say. So you had to be careful. Flush toilets, new. A cream separator. Typewriter. Light bulbs. And the first electric car. We're going back to electric cars.
Oh, there
cars,
you go.
But you could ride. They had one that you could take a little ride in, an electric car. So first time in Omaha.
So the Tony Stark of the Victorian era was there at the...
Exactly so. And you know, one of my favorite stories really wasn't a display at all, but it was a very bold move by the electrical engineer. His name was Henry Ruston. And the idea for, if those of you that have seen our display know how beautiful these buildings reflected off of the lagoon. And there were going to, and there still were, light posts around that were done in that neoclassical style. But Mr. Ruston said, but what if we outlined these buildings, and they were massive, massive buildings, with incandescent light bulbs. Those were the light bulbs that were new. Now, we're used to seeing, at least in Omaha, at Christmas time, people outline their houses all the time. But these were enormous buildings, and there were seven of them, and spread over six blocks.
Oy.
So your face is kind of, oh, man. That's exactly what his crew said. You know, if we do this, we're going to blow every circuit. And I should mention, there was electricity in Omaha, but the fair, because there was so much need out where it was, you could get there easily from downtown, but it was still a 12-minute streetcar ride. So they had their own generator. Yeah. So he said, yeah, but, you know, they said, oh, you know, it'll be a disaster. And he said, yeah, but if it works, it'll be great. So the first time they tried it, he really didn't know if it would hold. And the way the lights came on, it wasn't like all at once, all seven enormous buildings. They started at the east end, and the buildings are set up in pairs across the lagoon. And then at the far western end, anchoring across the whole width of it, is this beautiful U.S. government building. And when most people see it, they said, oh, that looks like the Capitol building. So if you've not been there, you can picture that.
Sure.
And then these other buildings were these beautiful, like, temples to different things. So the first time, and I always try to imagine what it must have been like, because they waited until dusk. And let's say you were there, and you were a kid from the farm, and this was all wow, everything, and you were just trying to take it all in, and then it gets to be dark, and all of a sudden, lights come on these first two sets of buildings, and you're standing there going, I mean, you're seeing what you're seeing, but you don't know, you can't explain what it is, and you start watching, and then the next two set of buildings, the lights come on there, and they hold. So by this time, the crowd that's there, who didn't know this was going to happen, are starting to notice. Two more come on, and then it's only the far one at the end will have to come on. And when the final lights came on the U.S. government building and held, from his journal, Mr. Ruston, he said, the first night it happened, I was almost too frightened to breathe because there was no sound. When all the lights came on, everyone was struck.
Oh, my goodness.
And he said, but the roar that went up from the crowd on that first night was the best moment of my life. So every night at dusk, those lights came on, and they came on as dramatically.
That's fantastic.
Yeah, isn't that a great story?
Oh, that's wonderful.
So it really was just his vision to do that.
Yes. And to take that risk.
To take that big risk. Yeah.
I don't know if he was breathing during that whole time.
He said not.
Yeah. So did anything I mean, that's a spectacular event that happened at the fair. Yeah. Can you think of anything notorious that would have happened or any urban legends that have sprouted up from this event in the city or anything?
Yes, I can.
Okay.
Notorious, but in a good way.
Okay.
One of the exhibitions, which is really odd to us as a modern person looking back, on the Midway for maybe a dime or so, you could go see human babies in an incubator.
Really?
It was a Midway display. At this point, it was it would be very tragic if you had a preemie baby. There was really no care at all, and if the child struggled, they were very often didn't survive. And there was a man who called himself Dr. Martin Cooney. Now, you noticed I said called himself.
Right.
Martin was from Germany and from a family of doctors, and he said he went to medical school, but it hasn't really been verified. So ethically, and today I'm sure this will make any medical person just cringe, but he had seen this technology and had seen how it was saving little ones that would not have made it. So the way he decided that at least he could get the word out is to go from fair to fair. So it was not just in Omaha, but although we might have been one of the first. I need to check that as well. But his plan was to set these up, and they really just looked like little clear glass ovens. He did have nurses on staff, and people would bring their babies. And this went on the entire time, and he's credited with saving almost 7,000 lives.
Oh, my goodness.
Because by the time it went from place to place, and people who had lost children said, I wish we had this. And the medical community, finally then, someone who was in the medical community got behind this movement, and the neonatal care actually began. So it's notorious, but it has a happy ending.
But yeah, 7,000 babies?
Mm-hmm.
Oh, my goodness. Mm-hmm.
And yeah, you can check him out. Martin Cooney was his name.
Martin Cooney. Mm-hmm. Doctor.
Doctor.
Quotes.
Air quotes. Air
quotes.
Mm-hmm. Dr. Cooney.
So this event, extraordinary as it, as we've talked about, it's absolutely amazing that it was here, yet there's no trace of it, and so many people don't know about it. Why do you think that is? It's such a huge event in Omaha's history. Why don't we know more about it?
Well, I'm a history person, so I find that hard to believe, but I can remember when I first came here, I didn't grow up in Omaha, and when I first came, I'd see that, and I still do that when I do tours at the museum. I'll say, where do you think this was? And very often people say, Washington, D.C., and I say, no, Omaha, Nebraska. I think partly because at the time, I mean, it was a big deal, but everyone knew they were short-lived, and you just moved on. And there was no, as a matter of fact, the land where this was became more valuable as home sites than a fair. Okay. So I just think the whole mindset of the time didn't really keep it going.
Sure.
You know? And what I feel is amazing about it, Omaha became a city in the late 1850s. There were 20 people here. Mm-hmm. 20. And this is 1898. We had 150,000 people, and we put on a World's Fair where 2.6 million people came. It was an extraordinary accomplishment. So I'm just glad it is being kept alive enough that people know it's there. But very often, I know we were in Nashville, and it was just kind of, oh, yeah, that's where the fair was. So maybe that's just, we need to be more, and even in Chicago, you have to want to find the fairgrounds to find it.
Sure.
So it's probably a combination of that was the times, and they came and they went, and then now, you know, now we're trying to resurrect it. But
yeah.
I don't have a really good answer, but it's a remarkable accomplishment.
Absolutely. If you could go back to the fair and talk to one person or experience one part of it, what would you pick?
Well, I think you know my heroes is Gurdon Waddles. I mean, he did get into trouble later on, but he really ran a fair. And I have to say, on one of my tours, a lady said to me at the end of it, you really should meet my friend because she is his granddaughter. And so I have met his granddaughter, and she shared, he wrote an autobiography, and it's a wonderful, you know, huge journal. But I just think that anybody that was on that committee that had that vision and the courage, because other states wanted to do this, and William Jennings Bryan kind of pushed that through. Other places in Omaha, you know, Hanscom Park was set up, and Riverview Park, where the zoo is today. There were other places it could have gone. And then the Kuntz brothers stepped up and kind of made a sweet offer they couldn't refuse. So, yeah, I think anybody on that board that had that vision, I would have loved to sit down and say, why? How come? That's great.
Well, unfortunately, we'll have to leave our look back at the transmiss there. Jean, thank you so much for coming on the show today and sharing your insights and understanding of this absolutely remarkable event.
So happy to do it.
And thank you all as well, our listeners, for joining us today. I'm your curator, Carrie Meyer, and I'll look forward to sharing more Omaha history with you next time on the Durham Museum Podcast.
The Durham Museum is located at 801 South 10th Street in Omaha, Nebraska. Visit us online at durhammuseum.org.
A Parkville Media Production.